When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Bad Sisters, Bad Sons edition. It's Wednesday, September 14th, 2022. On today's show, the incomparable Sharon Horgan co-creates, co-writes, and co-stars in Bad Sisters, a dark comedy about four sisters in Dublin who plot to rid their fifth sister of her evil husband. The series is on Apple TV Plus. I loved it. And then My Son Hunter is the first feature film, if you can call it that, from Breitbart, the right-wing media company. It's a lurid expose about the president's infamous fail son and his equally infamous laptop. And finally, we discuss the complex public emotions and iconography of Queen Elizabeth II with Slate's own icon, June Thomas. Joining me today is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Julia, hey.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Stephen.
All right, guys. Well, let's not stand on ceremony. Let's make a show. All right, well, Bad Sisters, it's a series on Apple TV Plus. It's part Big Little Lies, part James Joyce's The Dead. It's a dark comedy, a thriller, a satire, and a richly drawn portrait of an Irish family and the community it's embedded in. I kind of love the show. Co-created by, co-stars, and was co-written by Sharon Horgan, She of Catastrophe, and many other wonderful shows and movies. She plays one of five Garvey sisters, four of whom are tough, intelligent Irish women, one of whom has had a lot of the tough and almost all the life drawn out of her by her POS husband, a passive-aggressive sadist. Her four sisters decide to take matters very much into their own hands. They decide to relieve her of said POS, and by any means necessary. The show also stars Eve Hewson, Daryl McCormick, and I think drawing the hardest assignment, it's fair to say, is Anne Marie Duff, who plays Grace, the brutally put-upon wife. In the clip we're about to hear, the four quote-unquote bad sisters muse upon ways to dispatch John Paul, the creep of a husband, and one of the sisters happens upon the setup for the whole show, really. Let's listen.
People get killed every day.
What's that mean?
I mean, why not give nature a helping hand? All our worries would be over. I often think about punching through that soft spot in his head. Right through to his brain.
Jesus, BB.
I feed him to the Hurley's pigs. Bury him piece by piece in their mushroom beds. More shit for him to grow out of.
Fine, I'd tamper with the brakes of his shitty Volvo if I knew what the fuck I was doing.
Finally!
Shove him into deep, dark water.
Feed him to the sharks.
Let the seagulls
feed up his eyes out. Feed him to him on skewers.
Shove him out of a plane.
Kill the prick.
Kill the prick.
I fucking hate him.
All right, Julia, let me start with you. I picked up from a little pre-show chit-chat that maybe you don't share my love for this TV show. Do you care to explain?
Oh, that's not quite fair. I mean, it is so watchable. I devoured all of the five existing episodes. Sharon Horgan is so great. Don't you just, every time you see her on screen, you just wish you could hang out with her for the rest of your life, that she was like your sardonic best friend. She's like just so charismatic and charming.
Oh my God. I want to be the meek younger brother of the five bad sisters, like, or four bad sisters and the one put upon one.
Yeah, it's absolutely delightful company. I mean, for one thing, you've got sort of scenic mystery, unspecified Ireland locations, a lot of drone shots of beautiful greenery and people driving on the wrong side of the road. Sorry, Ireland. Then you've got all five sisters give fantastic performances, I think. They're all really compelling. They're well-drawn. They're very specific. The kind of abiding love and petty squabbling of their sisterhood is so well drawn, so well written, feels so earned. The thing that I curious about tonally and interested to see what the show does with its finale is I can't quite tell how morally serious the show is, which is maybe a kind of pinched way to evaluate a show that is just so much fun, and maybe it's a broad black comedy and who cares. But the portrayal of the relationship between the sisters is not broad. It's so real. It's so grounded. And the portrayal of the prick, John Paul, the kind of self-righteous, gaslighting, vicious, sadistic, unctuous, priggish, pervy. I mean, like, it's so broad. Like, he's not a subtly bad dude. He's like a dial-a-jerk. Like, literally every jerkish variety of man is embodied in him in a way that feels so broad.
Mm-hmm.
It's barely believable. And so I had trouble with the toggling between his unbelievable cruddiness and then the sisters' believable relationships. And so I felt like the show kind of is tonally swinging, and I can't tell how morally serious it is about the terrible thing the quote-unquote bad sisters set out to do.
Dana, are you bothered by the potential lack of moral seriousness, the contrast between these very humanized, very individuated sisters and this kind of cartoon big bad wolf of a husband?
I mean, now that Julia puts it so clearly, I think she did put her finger on something that has slightly bothered me about this, as even as, like Julia, I gobbled up every available episode and wished there were more, and largely because of Sharon Horgan, who I have to say, I mean, she co-wrote most of the episodes. She's obviously the co-creator of the show. I wish she was a little bit more the star. I think my first critique would be too many sisters. I mean, they're good characters, and if you stick with it, each one gets her own backstory and motivation and characterization in the episode. But it takes a couple episodes to even figure out how many there are, what their names are. It's really confusing because two of the actresses are named Eve and Ava, and that's also the name of Sharon Horgan's character. I just felt like I was in this welter of real and fake women that I was trying to keep straight for the first few episodes. And I might have done with a little bit more protagonist-based action of getting more time with Sharon Horgan, who also is, you know, the ringleader of the sisters. She's the oldest. In the backstory, she's sort of the mother figure because she brought them up when they were all orphaned. Like The Bear, another show about a big, sprawling, chaotic family we've talked about recently, this show could do with a little bit more deep backstory. I mean, I don't need necessarily flashbacks, but who were their parents that brought them up in this lovely seaside house that Sharon Horgan now lives in? I'd like to know a bit more about, you know, their education, their class background. What did their parents do for a living? Maybe that will all come out, but, you know, I'm now halfway into a 10-hour season and know absolutely nothing about sort of how they came to be the women they are. But I guess that's unrelated to Julia's question about the moral standing of the show. Here's what I'd have to say about that is one clue to the tonal oddness and the sense that we don't know whether this is a black comedy or a sensitive psychological drama. In other words, is it broad brush or fine-tipped brush? Is the genre tradition it comes from. I mean, this is an Irish show, but it clearly comes from the tradition of the cozy British mystery, right? I mean, I think it's very important that it takes place not in a city, right? They're not in the streets of Dublin having these conversations. They're in this little village. Maybe it's named. I don't remember if the town is named, but they're in a little seaside village in Ireland. And so everybody knows everybody else's business. You know, it's all very small town and sweet. And so this side story of the two insurance investigators who are looking into what they believe may be a crime is different from a cop show. You know, it's not a big city cop show with, you know, frowning cops knocking on the door. It's this dopey little local village mystery with a couple of bumbling insurance investigators trying to figure out whether to pay out a claim. And so that to me all points toward it being a black comedy where we're supposed to take in stride that, you know, something so ridiculous would happen. I mean, no one as smart as these five women are would actually conspire to do something so dumb, at which they're obviously going to get caught because none of them have any idea what they're doing. So I guess I took the whole thing with a healthy grain of salt as part of this history of the cozy British TV murder mystery in a small town where, you know, sort of arsenic and old lace style, where things are going to be sicker and darker than the sweet surface of the show would have you believe.
I mean, I kind of agree with both you and slightly quibble with both of you, because you're faced with a challenge if you're going to make this show. It's based on underlying material from, I believe it was a Belgian show, and then it might have been also a, I can't remember now, but it's been made before. But if, you know, starting with the MacGuffin, right, assuming that that's not the, in and of itself, the problem, maybe you shouldn't start with the MacGuffin. You have this problem of how to individuate the sisters, make them interesting figures, and then how to make him so toxic that you'll go along with it, that they're conspiring to kill him and apparently have succeeded in doing so. You know, you can't, if you subtly portray him and humanize him and give him, you know, a third dimension, your sympathy is not going to flow unabated to the sisters. And then you're in the realm of something, you know, truly dark and morally like complex. And that's not, as a, just as sheerly as a genre matter, that's not what this is. This is a dark comedy. And so to sort of balance the darkness and the comedy was hard. I mean, this is one of those had me at hello shows. I think the casting is brilliant. I think as you do get to know the sisters, they become, you know, very distinct from one another. I agree with Dana. It was a little disorienting at first. Midway through episode two, I had a sense of all of them. You know, the relationship between the two bumbling insurance executives as half brothers, you know, incredibly funny and well drawn. I mean, everything is comically precise in it. And the quibble I have, I guess, is that it's not only that I was able to make the leap with the show, I kind of saw what they were doing and had some respect for it, which is that, okay, if we're going to do this, if we're going to make him so flat that you fundamentally you're sort of rooting for him to get justice. You feel like justice is this guy being taken from the earth at some level. You know, it's not that they sacrificed what was so precise and finely drawn about the rest of the writing. It's just that they gave him nothing. Like every single little thing that he does to belittle, abuse, or intimidate his family is actually quite well and precisely drawn. The problem is that's all he does. And so as they begin to accumulate, it's all there is. And that's when it becomes flat in a way. But every single thing he does is actually quite believable. The fact is, it's just unrelenting and relatively, it's just continuous, right? I mean, there's just no kind of break. When he is present, he poisons everything that's happening.
Just as a counterpoint, like the Breitbart view of Hunter Biden is like far more human and sympathetic than the Sharon Horgan view of John Paul.
But here's what I think Steve is trying to say, and I agree with him on this bit, is that whether or not John Paul, the murder victim, is a bad guy is never even slightly up in the air. But the ways in which he's a bad guy are really sneakily written, right? I mean, yeah. He's almost abusive, right? He's passive aggressive, as Steve said. He's undermining. He's this kind of bad dad who's kind of constantly critiquing his daughter's body and her weight. And there's this awful moment where he gives her a pro-life pin for her confirmation. He's just always pushing his ideology on others in this horribly creepy way. And so there were moments where I admired the subtlety of the writing about the ways in which he was horrible.
Exactly.
But it was not an ambiguity as to whether he was a worthy person.
No, that's a good, it's a good clarification. The scenes in which he is horrible are just as subtle and almost realist in the like nuance of the characterization as the scenes of the sisters' relationship. That's, you're totally right. That's what's so odd about it, is like this buffoon cartoon is being delivered in this kind of like savvy realist tone, and it's a little odd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Steve, do you know who Eve Hewson is, who plays Becca?
No, but I know that Bono forever more will be known as Eve Hewson's father.
That's all I was asking. Man, she's fantastic,
yeah.
I think.
Like, I didn't know.
Sometimes you cock an eyebrow when the famous person's kid gets a part, but she's got the juice. But the other performance I wanted to single out, you flagged a little bit in your intro, but Grace, the sister who's not, you know, who is the put upon, abused, essentially, wife of the prick, gives just an amazing, I think, heartbreaking performance as sort of his prisoner. And there's a scene in episode 4 or 5 where in an effort at emotional independence, she tries to go to a dance class and what happens to her at that dance class and how it confronts her with her own like lack of embodied selfhood is just so heartbreaking. It's one of the most heartbreaking physical performances I've seen in a while. Like, she's just stunning. So I just wanted to shout out Anne-Marie Duff, who plays Grace on the show, who just is, that performance gets more complicated and more fascinating and more heartbreaking episode by episode.
Yeah, hear, hear. Okay, it's Bad Sisters. It's on Apple TV Plus. I think we're all telling you definitely to watch it. We did with enthusiasm, if also with intelligent reservations. I think it's a tremendous show. Love it. Check it out. All right, moving on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Well, listen, before we go any further, this is typically in the show where we discuss business. Dana, what do we have this week?
Stephen, the only item of business we have this week is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're going to talk about the Emmys, which aired on Monday, unusually this week. So the night before we're taping, it's all fresh news now. Julia, now that she's working in entertainment journalism, watched the entire show of the Emmys. I've more sort of kept an eye on it from afar, and Stephen didn't watch it all. So we're going to do a full-on interview with Julia about this particular ceremony, highs, lows, winners, losers, and also the status of the Emmy ceremony and award ceremonies in general on television at a moment when they're struggling to survive. If you're a Slate Plus member, you'll hear that segment at the end of today's show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can always sign up at slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member, you get ad-free podcasts. You get bonus content like that Emmy segment that I just described. Such segments exist on lots of other Slate shows as well. And of course, you get unlimited access to all of the writing on slate.com. When you're a Slate Plus member, you're supporting us and you're supporting the journalism of all of our brilliant colleagues. So please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. All right, on with the show.
Okay, for our second segment, I'm going to mix it up a little bit instead of the usual sententious, overwritten introduction. I'm going to go with a series of questions. So Dana, just try to relax, but remember you're under oath here. Ms. Stevens, what is the headline of your Slate piece?
I don't know what they called it. I think it's called...
Instruct the witness to answer the question. Ms. Stevens, one more time. What is the headline of your Slate piece?
It was something I was not fond of as a headline. I think it was, I watched the Hunter Biden movie, so you don't have to.
So you don't have to, am I correct? So you don't... And that you is a universal you, correct? Anyone who read your piece is therefore exempt from having to watch, according to you, the Hunter Biden movie, correct? And yet, what then happened, Ms. Stevens, when we did our topics call? And what did we end up with as a topic? And in order to fulfill my contractual obligation to the show, did I not, in fact, have to watch My Son Hunter?
Your Honor, objection. Right. I'm my own lawyer. I'm standing up for myself in court. It was not even my suggestion that we do this. I believe that one Julia Turner, Your Honor, was the one who suggested this as a topic, knowing that I was writing on the movie.
I did, and I will stand by it. This is such an interesting text. This is a much more interesting text than like half the movies we've seen in the last 6 months.
Okay, order in the court. All right, I'll try to get us back on track here. My Son Hunter is from Breitbart. Since this is a not movie to go with their not news sites designed to turn Americans into not citizens, I'll do a not introduction, but sort of introduction. Here's what I know. It's a $2.5 million budget. It was shot in Serbia. And it's one long, onanistic fever dream courtesy of the right-wing imagination. I just refuse to dignify it by describing the people involved in it as quote-unquote talent. So I'm not going to tell you who they were. I mean, if you guys want to, that's fine. What's curious about this movie is that it's trying so hard to look and sound like mainstream fare, exactly like Fox or Breitbart to a degree. It has familiar production values, and as with the new shows, like the familiar cocking of the head and gestures and the voicings of a news anchor, while dripping poison into the public ear. Why don't we listen to a clip? The one we're going to listen to, it takes place in a limo, as much of the movie does, in which Joe Biden, who's running for president, talks with, frequently lectures, and chides his son, especially when it comes to jeopardizing his run for office. Let's listen.
And I need you to tell me the God's honest truth. No lies. I don't care how bad it is, but I need you to tell me the truth. All right? Because if you don't tell me the truth, I can't fix it. And everything will be lost. Everything. Including my patience with you. Do you understand me, son?
Yes, sir.
Your word is abide.
My word is abide.
I want to know everything that's on that laptop that can ruin my erection. Every single detail. No need to be diplomatic now, so just give it to me straight.
I have a lot of selfies. Naked selfies.
Narcissistic. Not scandalous. What else?
Dana, this is a not movie, but you're a, you know, very real movie critic. So I guess I'll start with you. How do you even, as a film critic, approach a document like this?
You know, writing on this movie was a real challenge because, as you say, it's not in some sense a movie, certainly in terms of its release pattern and the its availability to the general public and its promotional strategy. Yeah, in a way, writing on this movie is less being a movie critic than being a media critic. And that was the way I tried to approach it. But as you can hear from that clip, this movie is trying to do a bunch of stuff at once. It's delivering this kind of fevered conspiracy theory about the laptop and the information that's been hidden that this movie's going to uncover. But it's also in this dumb comedic realm. Like, for example, the boing sound effect that you hear after the fake Joe Biden mistakenly says the word erection instead of election. That's kind of the level of this movie's humor in general. But yeah, it's kind of trying to do it all. It's trying to make you laugh at the ridiculousness of the Biden family while you also fear them as this international crime syndicate. It's trying, strangely, I want to get into this with Julia because I think she agrees with me. It's trying to humanize Hunter in a way that I really didn't expect, right? I mean, you would think that a movie called My Son Hunter, that's all about the evil laptop from hell of Hunter Biden, would make him look absolutely, you know, morally compromised. And I mean, while he seems like a very troubled figure in this movie, as played by Lawrence Fox, who I am going to acknowledge, who is an English actor who I think in a crazy way does a really good job humanizing Hunter Biden.
Yeah.
He's a manipulated figure that you feel, I think, a lot of pity for. The movie spends a lot of time luxuriating in the debauchery of Hunter Biden, this sort of well-documented history of his crack addiction and, you know, stuff that Biden himself has written about in a memoir. But it doesn't seem to luxuriate in a way that purely wants to, you know, humiliate and shame that character. I wonder what you think about that, Julia. Were you surprised by either his performance or the way the movie writes Hunter?
It was more movie-like than I expected it to be. And it seemed to understand certain things about form and tone that, you know, it was much more watchable than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I can't say I would send people out to it, but as a document of, like, you know, it can be edifying to watch Fox News, right, or Newsmax, and sort of understand how the world is processed and what kinds of information is shared in what tone with the sets of people who consume news via, think they are consuming news via those outlets, right? This film, as you pointed out in your review, it's sort of attempting to go for the, like, jaunty Adam McKay style recent news explainer with performances and kind of gratuitous stripping scenes vibe. Like, even that musical cue in that clip we heard had a bit of sort of like a bit of The Big Short, a bit of you know, kind of the Ocean's 11 Soderbergh type jauntiness to it. But as a formal project, this movie understands that we can't spend an hour or an hour and a half thinking about Hunter Biden without, that it's really hard to make him into a villain, given that he lost his mom and sister when he was two, then he lost his brother, then he fell into addiction, then he fell into a spiral of of chaos, and that he's just kind of a heartbreaking fuck up. Those are the bullet points of his story. So the movie that for 90 minutes was just like, here's a nefarious jerko scheming, doesn't quite make sense. And instead, the film presents him as a victim of Scheming Joe, which its portrayal of Scheming Joe is more broad and less human and less plausible. But it works weirdly well, I thought. And if you were the sort of person who did not follow the news particularly closely, wasn't really thinking about it very much, had heard something about Hunter Biden's laptop, then didn't hear about it for a while, I don't know, you might watch this and be like, huh, what's going on with that? What was that gotcha clip of Biden they played at the end? Like, it seems like an effective piece of propaganda to me.
I think you already have to be in the synergistic loop between Fox and the Fox audience, or Breitbart and the Breitbart audience. Like, Steve Bannon's already insinuated his way into your consciousness and your framing of reality, I think, before you can really start, you know, abusing this particular drug. I don't think of this as a gateway. And one of the reasons is, right up front, Black Lives Matters is demonized in the most cartoonish way. Like, I think it may even be the opening scene of the movie. I mean, it's just, you know, incredibly hypocritical. You know, they burned whole U.S. cities to the ground. You know, Portland is an incinerated crater. There's nothing left of it. Really? Like, I mean, that wouldn't, like, a somewhat informed, thinking, free-thinking person would watch that first scene and then proceed with the rest of it on trust. I mean, this seemed to me co-written by the kind of conscious manipulations of the right-wing media as they've accumulated in really genuinely tragic ways in the unconscious minds of a portion of the American audience that's overwhelmingly older and white. And it's that co-writing that creates these preposterously flat portrayals of virtually everybody in it except for Hunter. And the only reason Hunter is given any depth is that just sharpens the spear against its actual target, which is Joe, obviously. They don't give a shit about Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden's entirely instrumental, and humanizing him is entirely instrumental, because the more human Hunter is, the more the manipulations of his venal, preening, horrible, imperially egomaniacal and ambitious father, seem inhumane and degrading. So, I mean, you know, I just think it was ridiculous. But that said, Julia, you sent around a New York Magazine piece that's a deep dive on this story. It's not as though there's nothing there, right? Like, that's where the actual difference between quote unquote our side and quote unquote their side actually does come, is that our news organizations are real news organizations, and our capacity for open-mindedness involves an actually open mind. If there's a factual basis for the accusation, for example, that Hunter, one of the reasons Hunter is such a miserable quote-unquote fuck-up or fail-son or whatever, is that he essentially has been the member of the family who's sacrificed to, you know, a series of corrupt acts meant to enrich, you know, a public servant, if that's true. And the reporting doesn't demonstrate that yet, but it's not as though there isn't something to follow up on of substance. The problem, of course, is that it's so fucking clouded over now by conscious production of misperception on the part of a portion of the electorate. The actual digital data itself has been overwritten upon and manipulated and corrupted. It is not that easy to tell what actually originates from Hunter Biden and what doesn't. Nonetheless, are you telling me the Washington Post, if it tomorrow could definitively report on Burisma being an attempt to send millions of dollars into the Biden's pocket, and that also demonstrably corrupted U.S. policy on Ukraine, you're telling me they wouldn't report that? That's crazy. And, you know, I think they would. And Dana, I just have to point out one thing that I'd laughed and laughed and laughed my head off at, which is towards the end of the movie, this also preposterously drawn, I guess, stripper figure who Hunter has something like resembling a real relationship in the movie, turns out to, like, she suddenly becomes their version of woke and realizes this, you know, grotesque conspiracy that she's up against. And in all of these, like, crudely drawn, like, sub-cartoonish scenes, she, like, you know, gets some recording of him basically admitting everything, and she takes it to some journalist friend she knows. Well, she phones him up, and the guy answering the phone on the other end is like Jimmy Stewart in the Philadelphia Story. He's like an anachronism upon an anachronism. He's like bespectacled. He's at a fucking manual typewriter, and he's wearing togs out of the
1940s. Yeah, he needs a press card in his fedora, like, is what he's missing.
I was like, maybe they have a, like, incredibly good sense of humor, subtle sense of humor over at Breitbart. They're like, this is the dump shits who are watching this movie don't even know what a journalist in 2022 looks like, you know? And it's like, wink, wink, you know, we know how dumb the people watching this are. But that, on a more serious note, that just shows, like, the distance from which the average viewer of this movie is presumed to exist from actual journalists, actual people who actually hold power. Nobody in this movie talks like their real life equivalent would, or much less looks like them.
But Steve, part of what you put your finger on, so the New York Magazine piece that I sent around is a relatively new feature by a couple of their reporters that's sort of looking holistically and with a kind of narrative angle at the story of Hunter Biden's laptop. What happened to it, what it actually is, how the data was passed from hand to hand, what hay has been made of it, and what actual grist for investigation or potential problematic behavior by Hunter or even potentially Joe Biden himself might or might not be in it. And it was useful to me as someone who had not followed all the non-narrative work that has been done by real journalists about this over the last few years, to kind of read it all in one place in the same 24 hours in which I watched this very odd document of the mind of the right. But, you know, fundamentally, the movie's main thrust is that the mainstream media is keeping you from the truth. Another recurring theme is that the Joe of the movie is, you know, a lecherous hair sniffer. So in addition to being a doddering fool and a criminal mastermind, he's also a creepy lech. But if you, you know, are Republican or Republican leaning or pro-Trump, you notice like, oh, wow, the media kind of covered this gross behavior and then it kind of ignored it and let it drop. Or, you know, the movie also makes a lot of hay of the fact that it doesn't actually really explain the timeline, but when news of the laptop first broke in the New York Post, a bunch of the platforms, Twitter and Facebook, kind of cracked down on information sharing about it because it was so close to the election, and there was a sense that the information on the laptop couldn't be verified. Since then, it seems increasingly like some of the information on the laptop probably is real, and the jury's still out on that a bit. But the sense, you know, in the same way that folks on the left look back at 2016 and think, why the hell did the media spend so much time on Hillary Clinton's emails? The notion that there's a subset of people who look back at the media coverage of the 2020 election and think, why the hell did everybody ignore Hunter Biden's laptop and what the hell is really going on with it? When in fact, parts of it were real. And maybe there are some stories there. Like, that's an understandable thing for people of this political persuasion to seize upon. What the movie completely leaves out in its propagandic approach to all this is that, in fact, many major media outlets have followed these threads and covered bits and pieces of the Burisma story, the laptop story, in various modes. There have been some investigative work by both the Washington Post and the New York Times. Like, it is a story that mainstream journalists are pursuing. It's true that it hasn't become like the main thread on cable news. And I think the kind of confusion of cable news with journalism broadly is one of the problematic delusions. Like, really finding the actual truth takes time.
Yeah, Julia, when I read that that long reported piece that you sent around for us about the uncovering of the laptop and the status of the investigation into it, all I could think of was, I want the Hunter Biden movie about the guy who found the laptop, the Delaware Mac repairman who found himself with this hot item on his hands and was suddenly getting calls from Steve Bannon and Rudy Giuliani and God knows who. That's a movie that I would watch.
Brad Pitt in a Coen Brothers film?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Brad Pitt. Perfect for a Brad Pitt dumb role, which is always his best. There's so much more to say about this movie, Steve, but I don't think we can get into it all in this segment.
Yeah, that's true. And what I would say is your piece is, for all my glibness up top, is terrific. And people should go check it out. Dana, remind me again, what's the title of it?
It's called I Watched the Hunter Biden Movie, So You Don't Have to.
Okay. We'll leave it there. It's up on Slate. Let's move along.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Welcome to the Snapple Market Auditory Experience. Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your neighborhood store. You make your way to the back and reach for your favorite Snapple flavor. You can't wait. You take a sip. Whoa, that's a lot of flavor. What flavor are you holding? Now open your eyes and check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavorful Snapple near you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. Well, we're joined by June Thomas. She's joining us from Edinburgh, Scotland. June, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Of course, you're here to talk about Queen Elizabeth II, the longest reigning monarch in the history of England. She was all of 25 when she ascended the throne in 1952. Her reign covers then, I think, arguably virtually the entire post-war era through the post-war rationing. You never had it so good to Thatcher and Brexit. June, let's talk a little bit about just what you're experiencing and hearing both inside your own self and on the ground there in the UK.
It's interesting that I'm in Scotland. I'm now living in Edinburgh for all of not even 3 weeks, because until about 20 minutes before we started recording, you know, we were the center of the world's attention, I guess, or whoever's paying attention's attention, because she died at Balmoral. Instead of Operation London Bridge, Operation Unicorn kicked in, which meant that, okay, if she died in Scotland, there would be a slightly different procedure. And so the eyes of the world have been here, or so it's felt. And there's a sense, just for me personally, that's kind of cool, but it's also disturbing because there have been these ridiculous arrests in a world where it really seems that even people, you know, you can just sit it out. You don't have to get in the middle of it, especially since this is, you know, a death, a period of mourning. But the fact that people were arrested merely for holding signs, obviously that is incredibly disturbing. And so it's not all, oh, hey, it's great. Isn't this a wonderful event? Like, that is definitely a very negative situation.
June, since you kick off talking about the protests and the fact that there's some sort of question even in the streets around you as to how the Queen should best be mourned, I mean, I hate to take this immediately to the level of the response to the Queen's death as opposed to the intrinsic meaning of the event for England and the world, but it just seems to a huge degree now that anything having to do with the monarchy is immediately going to turn into a referendum on whether that monarchy should continue to exist or not. And I wonder both how that has struck you personally and how you've felt about the social media response to the Queen's death, which it seems to me, I mean, I've basically tried to keep off social media the last few days because this has just turned into such blanket coverage. It's all you can hear about, right? I mean, either someone's somewhat saccharine post about mourning or someone else's, you know, dancing on the Queen's grave kind of post, and then the fight that breaks out after that. And I'm wondering whether you think, first of all, that that is intensifying to a point where, you know, the conversation is going to go beyond social media, and, you know, just how you've experienced the, you know, public in the larger sense of the virtual public's response to this event.
Yeah, it's tricky because the protests do, as you say, like reminders that this is a very contested institution. There seems to be this, even for unlike the BBC, which even today is still, you know, it's the official voice. And so it's quite respectful, you know, perhaps a little bit more respectful than it needs to be. But, you know, there will be some sort of admission, perhaps, that there may be a larger discussion of the role of royalty or the purpose of royalty or the size of royalty or just, you know, essentially some existential discussion. But then there is a kind of a pause and then they say, but for the moment, we are, you know, celebrating the life of a woman who, and this is, I think, universally accepted even among those of us who, you know, have no love whatsoever for the institution and for the role of the monarchy, will say, this was a woman who worked her ass off. And, you know, we live in a time where work is the thing that we all universally praise. And so, you know, there's that kind of feeling of, well, we'll kick that down the road a little bit. And then at the same time, you are reminded of the great unfairness of life and, you know, just all of the ways that royalty also means privilege and establishment. When one of the people who was arrested in Edinburgh was arrested for yelling at Prince Andrew, as he somehow is still referred to, for being a paedophile, when, you know, that doesn't actually seem like that is such a contested statement. And he was the man who yelled this, was arrested, and Andrew does not seem to have suffered any significant consequences beyond having to walk behind his mother's body in a suit rather than the uniforms that are so beloved by members of the royal family. So, you know, and he actually did serve, of course, in the Falklands. So, you know, there's all of that. And then there is what people say, which is really inspiring, of I feel like I'm, you know, living history, which we all are every day. But there is this feeling that this is a really significant moment. And, you know, you don't want to take a dump on that because, you know, that's a feeling that we should all have all the time, I think.
One thing that's been striking to me in the coverage I've encountered is how moved and respectful a wide swath of generations seem to be. And something that's cropped up in a lot of the commentaries is just this final sense of unlinking from empire, which, you know, you might think as a rabble-rousing American, everyone's like, woohoo, we're done with the empire. But there seems like a bit of mournfulness or melancholy about losing that direct living link to the status loss, the kind of global status loss that came with the end of empire, and almost a sense that the queen, like, helped preserve the nation's dignity in the face of its, the dissolution of its imperialist ambitions. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of left people up and down the political spectrum kind of like, oh man, remember when we were the big kahuna? Gosh, that was, this is a direct quote from the BBC. gosh, that was nice. And it made me realize, I was speaking once to a British friend who was talking about how history is taught in the British system. And essentially, he was like, yeah, your revolution isn't like the major event in our history. You know, like the American Revolution is like a sidebar, like one of those little like colored boxes on the edge. That's like, and then those pesky people were like, see ya, but whatever, onward march Britain. And I guess I would love to hear your take on, you know, living in America, processing culture in America right now. There is so much challenging of our own founding myths. And it made me realize that I don't feel like I totally understand how British culture processes the dissolution of its potency.
Yeah, I think here the talk really is about the Commonwealth, you know, the Commonwealth of Nations, in part because the Queen was a really big believer in and kind of proselytizer for the Commonwealth. And over time, it would be like there were 52 members, there were 40 members. You know, there's just a consciousness that it's a shrinking organization. And I don't think that it's been about loss of power or loss of status or loss of empire. I mean, that ship has sailed, and I really don't think that other than, you know, perhaps a fringe of people, there's a great deal of kind of constant mourning for that or contemporaneous mourning for that. But just a feeling that, you know, maybe related to Brexit for, you know, for those who celebrate, you know, that our world is shrinking a little bit, that it's harder for, you know, what was once even just, you know, people from the European Union, you know, people from the Commonwealth to kind of represent themselves or to see themselves in this country or to move to this country, to live in this country that, you know, that they're supposedly, you know, part of this system, you know, living under the Queen's bounty or reign or whatever it is. And yeah, I don't think people will be really pushing to, you know, to have King Charles on their notes. So yeah, it does feel significant that it's a moment, you know, a moment is changing, history is changing, a moment is passing. This doesn't seem to be about a loss of power, but just like, oh wow, this will be different. That it's too bad that the world is shrinking in a way.
Yeah, June, I agree with you that's the emphasis. That sounds right to me. Also, in part because, with all due respect to the process of decolonialization, which allowed for national self-determination on the part of peoples who'd been under a boot, you know, for centuries, which I'm not minimizing at all, my sense of it is that the real sort of diminishment of national ego occurred when, after the Second World War, it was evident that the United States was the, you know, global hegemon, and clearly the quote-unquote leader of the free world, and both the UK and the continent were going to exist under our nuclear umbrella, and on and on and on. I mean, there was just a complete reversal of roles and the acceptance of secondary status militarily and financially, you know, Bretton Woods and on and on and on. And at that point, the English, in my interpretation, begin doing a, by and large, exquisite job of performing and marketing Englishness to a nostalgic world.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's the consumer, yeah. What the principal consumer. I mean, the reason why the royal family is such a cash cow is essentially tourism, right? I mean, it's the rest of the world consumes this nostalgia, including people from the former colonies, right? It's like a very interesting form of comfort that one derives from somebody else's venerable tradition, even as it's associated with placing the rest of the world into a secondary or subordinate status. And I, in that sense, I think of the Queen as of a piece with Penny Lane and James Bond and Harry Potter in some sense, but with this difference that even though she took the throne just as television was becoming a paramount medium, she herself, her early life, preceded the rise of TV. And I think this is one of those things that's so big, so pervasive, and so obvious we can't see it. That to be the final generation, as, for example, my parents were, of people who fully became fully formed human beings before the rise of television meant they had a different consciousness than everyone who came after that. And I'm not hierarchizing it or placing a value judgment on it. It's simply an observation. And for someone like me, who's just at the beginning of television becoming totally pervasive to consciousness, who had parents who were pre-TV, I have a nostalgia for the queen that's related to the idea of a bearing and being in the world that is non-televisual, that then translates beautifully onto television, and the nostalgia of people who want to believe in that kind of dignity and continuity. So in that sense, I think what I project as a kind of sentimental longing onto this figure, who otherwise means very little to me, is just a sense of dignity and self-possession, and that she exists apart from the cameras that turn her into the icon. That's her iconographic power to me. And that, I suspect, for better and for worse, even Charles lacks to a degree, and then whoever comes after Charles will lack almost completely.
On the question of Charles and whether the monarchy survives, I was struck. The official confirmation I saw came via tweet. I think it was a tweet linking to an official pronouncement of whatever the next step in Operation Unicorn was. But it was so striking to me that it was the same tweet, not even a thread, that was like, the queen is dead, the king and queen consort are on their way to wherever. It's like there was no public breath of her death that did not immediately supplant with a king. And it just felt like they didn't want to leave any time for anybody to be like, I mean, she had a great run. Are you sure we still need one? Maybe Charles isn't the guy.
Like, even Law and Order has to come to an end at some point. You know, I mean, the show, not the the institution, because that's already happening in America. But but what is that? Why is the phrase so famous? The Queen is dead. Long live the King. You know, I mean, yeah. That so it was. So it always will be. But especially now, yeah.
Okay. Well, June, we've gone over. We could talk about this more, but it's great, great having you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have for us today?
Steve, I'm mainly sharing my endorsement this week just to brag that I finally finished it. When you listen to a really long audiobook, it's just a satisfying yet sad feeling when you get to the end of it and leave that world and that voice that's been in your ears for so long. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are audiobook fans, so I like to recommend audiobooks once in a while. And the one that I just sadly finished, extra sadly, because this is my last book I had not read by this author, was Shirley by Charlotte Bronte, which is the second to last. It was the follow-up to Jane Eyre, the second novel that Charlotte Bronte published in her lifetime. And I had never read it because I guess it's sort of considered the black sheep of Charlotte Bronte novels. It's the only one that's narrated in the third person. It was not very well received at the time, whereas Jane Eyre had been a giant smashing success. And it's a really unusual and strange book. Maybe not my favorite of her books, but an extremely interesting one to listen to, especially on audio, because it's her most multivocal book. It's told by an omniscient narrator who sort of dips in and out of various characters' consciousnesses. It's a social novel that tells the story of industrial riots in England at the turn of the 19th century, so a little bit before the time it was written in. And it's just got this huge cast of characters with just a whole village of people and rectors and aristocrats and work people running in and out and two female protagonists who sort of vie for both the prime status as narrator and the love object of one of the main male leads. Anyway, it's a huge sprawling story that obviously I can't summarize here, but it's really, really great, read in your ears by a reader named Georgina Sutton, who manages to get everything down to the sort of men's voices, the women's voices, the Yorkshire accents, the Southern accents. She's a wonderful, wonderful reader who gets all the nuances of this novel. And especially if you're interested in the Brontes and how all their careers developed, you have to listen to Shirley. It's a key piece of the puzzle. So Shirley on Audible, read by Georgina Sutton.
Oh, that is magnificent. Okay, you have put me onto it, and I'm going to follow up. Julia, what about you?
I've got two endorsements. The first is possibly the silliest thing I've ever endorsed, which, you know, is saying something. But there is a kind of like fancy salon style shampoo company called Sacha-Juan. I don't actually know how you say it. I've never said it out loud. It's S-A-C-H-A-J-U-A-N. And they have a number of shampoos and conditioners that are nice. They also sell for $17 something called the Sacha-Juan Scalp Brush. And it's basically this like little round hockey puck shaped brush with a little handle and then maybe 12 conical rubber points on it. And if, while you are shampooing your hair, you like rub this scalp brush over your scalp, you have the exact same feeling as when you go get your hair cut at the salon and the very strong fingered hair washing person like really like abrades your scalp with their vigorous scrubbing, which if you are like me is a sensation you very much enjoy. But I've only been able to experience like, you know, however often you get your hair cut at the salon, which if you're me is hardly ever. Now you can have that sensation in your very own shower for $17 with the Sacha-Juan scalp brush. You're welcome, everybody. I think you should all be grateful that I am not too embarrassed to endorse such a ridiculous thing, but it's truly an additional pleasure in your life should you be so inclined. My second endorsement is that a marvelous author is coming to Los Angeles this weekend. Her name is Dana Stevens. She's written a wonderful book about Buster Keaton, and she's going to be talking and reading from her book at the Village Well Books and Coffee in Culver City, which is a great bookstore, a new bookstore, a woman-owned bookstore, happens to be owned by a Culture Fest fan. So Dana will be there. I will be there. It's this coming Saturday at 5 p.m. at Village Well Books.
Ah, thanks for the plug, Julie. I was wondering how to get that on the show without hogging up a bunch of for endorsement, self-endorsement. But yes, I will be in LA this weekend for that and another event. On Sunday, I'm hosting a screening of a Buster Keaton movie. So if anybody wants more information about either of those two, you can write us at culturefest@slate.com and I'll send you the info.
That's great. All right, I'm going to endorse. First of all, I'm just going to return to Transit of Venus, the novel by Shirley Hazard. I've been reading it over several months. On and off, it's sunk in now. That is one of the best novels I've ever read. Dana, I forgot if I asked you, have you ever read that?
Nope, have not read.
It is such a great book. But my actual endorsement is an interview with Stephen Chapin, the philosopher of science at Harvard, who I think is just a national treasure and a real deserves to be considered an institution. It's in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. We'll link to it, and the title of it is wonderful. It's from a quote. It's from something Chapin says. In the course of the interview, there's no shame in being a hack. And Chapin's just a person who's mastered the philosophy of science and history of science as someone who started out as a serious scientist, so he knows of what he speaks, but writes with total clarity and simplicity, lucidity, directness, no pretension at all, about really interesting, abstruse subjects. And relatively late in his career, he'd been a wine connoisseur, it sounds like, most of his adult life, but he began thinking seriously about what that meant in philosophical terms. And actually, it's so interesting to hear him talk about that, because on the one hand, he's got a sense of humor about life and himself, so it's unserious in some fun way, or it's fun and whatever, but it's actually serious because it addresses these really deep philosophical questions about taste, judgment, objectivity, and subjectivity. And just very quickly, he says, it can be serious because if you're, quote, interested in objectivity, you should be interested in subjectivity. You should be interested in the how they do it question. How is objective knowledge made and portrayed? How are subjective judgments made and portrayed? It's a great interview. The man's just an extraordinary philosophical and literary, in my estimation, talent. Once again, that's an interview with Stephen Chapin, the Harvard philosopher of science, in the Chronicle of Higher Education. We will link to it on our website. All right. Thanks, Julia. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by Nicholas Patel. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.